Welcome to Love's Tender Flame. Tales of Romance. I'm Wardell, reading the auction block by Rex Beach. Chapter 2. Mr. Campbell Pope was a cynic. He had cultivated a superb contempt for those beliefs which other people cherish. He rejoiced in an open rebellion against convention, and manifested this hostility in an exaggerated carelessness of dress and manner. It was perhaps his habit of thought, as much as anything else, that had made him a dramatic critic. But it was a knack for keen analysis and a natural caustic wit that had raised him to eminence in his field. Outwardly, he was a sloven and a misanthrope. Inwardly, he was simple and rather boyish, but years of experience in a box office, then as advance man and publicity agent for a circus, and finally as a Metropolitan reviewer, had destroyed his illusions and soured his taste for theatrical life. His column was widely read. His name was known. As a prophet, he was uncanny. Hence managers treated him with a gingerly courtesy, not always quite sincere. Most men attain success through love of their work. Mr. Pope had become an eminent critic because of his hatred for the drama and all things dramatic. Nor was he any more enamored of journalism, being in truth by nature bucolic, but after trying many occupations and failing in all of them, he had returned to his desk after each excursion into other fields. First night audiences knew him now, and had come to look for his thin, sharp features, his shapeless, wrinkled suit that resembled a sleeping bag, his flannel shirt always tieless and frequently collarless, were considered attributes of genius, and finding New York to be amazingly gullible, he took a certain delight in accentuating his eccentricities. At especially prominent premieres, he affected a sweater underneath his coat, but that was his nearest approach to formal evening dress. Further concession to fashion, he made none. Owing to the dearth of new productions this summer, Pope had undertaken a series of magazine articles descriptive of the reigning theatrical beauties, and while he detested women in general, and the painted favorites of Broadway in particular, he had forced himself to write the common laudatory stuff which the public demanded. Only once had he given free rein to his inclinations and written with a poisoned pen. Tonight, however, as he entered the stage door of Bergman's Circuit Theater, it was with a different intent. Reagan, the stage door tender, better known since his vaudeville days as the judge, answered his greeting with a lugubrious shake of his bald head.
"I'm a sick man, Mr. Pope. Same old trouble."
"Kidneys, isn't it?"
"No, rheumatism. I'm a beehive swarming with pains."
"To be sure, it's Hemphill, the doorman at the Columbus, who has the floating kidney. I paid for his operation."
"Hemphill? Operation? Ah!"
the judge cackled in a voice hoarse from alcoholic excesses.
"He bilked you, Mr. Pope. He's the guy that put the kid in kidney. There's nothing wrong with him. He could do his old acrobatic turn if he wanted to."
"I remember the act.
Me and Greenberg played the same bill with him 20 years ago.
The judge leaned forward, and a strong odor of whiskey enveloped the caller.
"Could you slip me 4 bits for some liniment?"
The critic smiled.
"There's a dollar, Reagan. Try scotch for a change. It's better for you than these cheap blends.
Don't breathe toward a lamp or you'll ignite." The judge laughed wheezingly.
"I do take a drop now and then."
"A drop? You'd better take a tumble or Bergman will let you out."
Say here, you know all the managers, Mr. Pope. Can't you find a job for a swell dame? The judge inquired anxiously. Who is she? Lottie Devine. She's out with the Peach Blossom girls. Lottie Devine? Why, she's your wife, isn't she? Sure, plays the wheel when she belongs in musical comedy. She dances as good as she did when we worked together. After she gets warmed up. And she looks great in tight, swellest legs and burlesque, Mr. Pope. Can't you place her? She's a trifle old, I'm afraid. She wigs up a lot better than some of the squabs in this troupe. Believe me, she'd fit any chorus. Well, why don't you ask Bergman?
Mr. Reagan shook his hairless head.
He's dippy on types. This show's full of 'em. Real blondes. Real brunettes, bold and dashing ones, tall and statelies, blushers, shrinkers, laughers, saddlings. He won't stand for makeup. He wants them with the dew on. They've got to look natural for Bergman. Oh, there's some of them now.
He nodded toward a group of young, fresh-cheeked girls who had entered the stage door and were hurrying down the hall.
They ain't a hypnotized ensemble in the whole first act, and they wear talcum powder instead of tights. It's dimples he wants, not fats. How them girls stand the draft, I don't know. It would kill an old-timer.
I've come to interview one of Bergman's types, that new beauty, Miss Knight. Is she here yet?
Sure, her and her backdrop, too. She carries the old woman for scenery.
Mr. Reagan took the caller's card and shuffled away, leaving Pope to watch the stream of performers as they entered and made for their quarters. There were many women in the number, and all of them were pretty. Most of them were overdressed in the extremes of fashion. A few quietly garbed ladies and gentlemen entered the lower dressing rooms reserved for the principals. It was no novel sight to the reviewer whose theatrical apprenticeship had been thorough, yet it never failed to awaken his deepest cynicism. Somewhere within him was a puritanical streak, and he still cherished youthful memories. He reflected now that it was he who had laid the foundation for the popularity of the girl he had come to interview, for he had picked her out of the chorus of the preceding review and commented so enthusiastically upon her beauty that this season had witnessed her advancement to a speaking part. Through Pope's column, attention had been focused upon Bergman's latest acquisition, and once New York had paused to look carefully at this fresh young newcomer, her fame had spread. But he had never met the girl herself, and he wondered idly what effect success had had upon her. A total absence of scandal had argued against any previous theatrical experience. Meanwhile, he exchanged greetings with the star, a clear-eyed man with the face of a scholar and the limbs of an athlete. The latter had studied for the law. He had the drollest legs in the business, and his salary exceeded that of a Supreme Court justice. They were talking when Mr. Reagan returned to tell the interviewer that he would be received. Pope followed to the next floor and entered a brightly lighted, overheated dressing room, where Lorelei and her mother were waiting. It was a glaring, stuffy cubbyhole, ventilated by means of the hall door and a tiny window opening from the lavatory at the rear. Along the sides ran mirrors, beneath which was fixed a wide makeup shelf. From the ceiling depended several unshaded incandescent globes, which flooded the place with a desert heat and radiance. An attempt had been made to give the room at least a semblance of coolness by hanging an attractively figured cretonne over the entrance and over the wardrobe hooks fixed in the rear wall. But the result was hardly successful. The same material had been utilized to cover the shelves, which were littered with a bewildering assortment of makeup tins, cold cream cans, rouge and powder boxes, whitening bottles, wig blocks, and the multifarious, disordered accumulations of a dressing room. The walls were half hidden behind photographs. Impaled upon pins like entomological specimens, photographs were thrust into the mirror frames. They were propped against the heaps of tins and boxes, or hidden beneath the confusion of toilet articles. But the collection was not limited to this variety of specimen. One section of the wall was devoted to telegraph and cable forms bearing messages of felicitation at the opening of the Review of 1913. A zoologist would have found the display uninteresting, but a society reporter would have reveled in the names, especially in the sentiments inscribed upon the yellow sheets. Some were addressed to Lorelei Knight, others to Lilas Lynn, her roommate. Pope found Lorelei completely dressed, in expectation of his arrival. She wore the white and silver first-act costume of the fairy princess. Both she and her mother were plainly nonplussed at the appearance of their caller. But Mrs. Knight recovered quickly from the shock and said agreeably,
"Lorelei was frightened to death at your message yesterday. She was almost afraid to let you interview her, after what you wrote about Adore Demarest."
Pope shrugged.
"Your daughter is altogether different to the star of the palace garden, Mrs. Knight. Demarest trades openly upon her notoriety, and I don't like bad women. New York never would have taken her up if she hadn't been advertised as the wickedest woman in Europe, for she can neither act, sing, nor dance. However, she's become the rage, so I had to include her in my series of articles. Now, Miss Knight has made a legitimate success as far as she has gone."
He turned to the girl herself, who was smiling at him, as she had smiled since his entrance. He did not wonder at the prominence her beauty had brought her, for even at this close range, her makeup could not disguise her loveliness. The lily had been painted, to be sure, but the sacrilege was not too noticeable, and he knew that the cheeks beneath their rouge were faintly colored, that the lashes under the heavy beading were long and dark and sweeping. As for her other features, no paint could conceal their perfection. Her forehead was linelessly serene. Her brows were straight and too well defined to need the pencil. As for her eyes, too much had been written about them already. They had proven the despair of many men, or so rumor had it. He saw that they had depths and shadows and glints of color that he could not readily define. Her nose, pronounced perfect by experts on noses, seemed faultless indeed. Her mouth was no tiny Cupid's bow, but generous enough for character. Of course, the lips were glaringly red now, but the expression was nonetheless sweet and friendly. "There's nothing legitimate about musical shows," she told him in reply to his last remark, "and I can't act or sing or dance as well as Miss Demarest."
"You don't need to. Just let the public rest its eyes on you, and it will be satisfied. Anyhow, it should be. Of course everybody flatters you. Has success turned your head?"
Mrs. Knight answered for her daughter,
"Lorelei has too much sense for that. She's succeeded easily, but she isn't spoiled."
Then, in response to a question by Pope, Lorelei told him something of her experience. "We're upstate people, you know. Mr. Bergman was looking for types, and I seemed to suit, so I got an engagement at once. The newspapers began to mention me, and when he produced this show, he had the part of the fairy princess written in for me. It's really very easy, and I don't do much except wear the gowns and speak a few lines."
"You're one of the principals," her mother said chidingly. "I suppose you're ambitious," Pope put in.
Again the mother answered,
"Indeed she is, and she's bound to succeed. Of course she hasn't had any experience to speak of, but there's more than one manager that's got his eye on her."
The listener inwardly cringed.
"She could be starred easy, and she will be, too, in another season."
"Then you must be studying hard, Miss Knight." Lorelei shook her head.
"Not even voice culture?"
"No."
"Nor dancing, nor acting?"
"No."
She has so little time. You've no idea how popular she is, twittered Mrs. Knight.
Pope fancied the girl herself, flushed under his inquiring eye. At any rate, her gaze wavered, and she seemed vexed by her mother's explanation. He, too, resented Mrs. Knight's share in the conversation. He did not like the elder woman's face, nor her voice, nor her manner. She impressed him as another theatrical type with which he was familiar. The stage mama. He found himself marveling at the dissimilarity of the two women.
"Of course, a famous beauty does meet a lot of people," he said. "Tell me what you think of our nourishing little city and our New York men."
But Lorelei raised a slender hand. "Not for worlds. Besides, you're making fun of me now. I was afraid to see you, and I'd feel terribly if you printed anything I really told you. Good interviewers never do that. They come and talk about nothing, then go away and put the most brilliant things into your mouth."
"You are considered a very dangerous person, Mr. Pope."
"You're thinking of my story about that Demarest woman again," he laughed.
"Is she really as bad as you described her?"
"I don't know, never having met the lady. I wouldn't humiliate myself by a personal interview, so I built a story on the Broadway gossip. Inasmuch as she goes in for notoriety, I gave her some of the best I had in stock. Her photographer did the rest."
The door curtains parted, and Lila Slynn, a slim, black-eyed young woman, entered. She greeted Pope cordially as she removed her hat and handed it to the woman who acted as dresser for the two occupants of the room.
"I am late as usual," she said, "but don't leave on my account." She disappeared into the lavatory and emerged a moment later in a combing jacket. Seating herself before her own mirrors, she dove into a cosmetic can and vigorously applied a priming coat to her features, while the dresser drew her hair back and secured it tightly with a wig band.
"Lorelei's got her nerve to talk to you after the panning you gave Demarest," she continued. "Aren't you ashamed of yourself to strike a defenseless star?"
Pope nodded. "I am, and I'm ashamed for my entire sex when I hear of them flocking to the palace garden just to see a woman who has nothing to distinguish her but a reputation for vileness."
"Did you see the crown jewels? The king's cabochon rubies?" Lorelei asked.
"Only from the front, I dare say they're as counterfeit as she is."
Miss Lynn turned, revealing a countenance as shiny as that of an Eskimo belle, with her war paint only half applied and her hair secured closely to her small head. She did not in the least resemble the dashing countess of the program.
"Oh, they're real enough. I got that straight,"
Campbell Pope scoffed.
"Isn't it true about the king of Seldovia? Didn't she wreck his throne?" eagerly queried Mrs. Knight.
"I never met the king, and I haven't examined his throne, but, you know, kings can do no wrong, and thrones are easily mended."
But Mrs. Knight was insistent. Her eyes glittered. Her sharp nose was thrust forward inquisitively.
"They say she draws $2,000 a week, and won't go to supper with a man for less than $500. She says if fellows want to be seen in public with her, they'll have to pay for it. And she's right. Of course, she's terribly bad, but you must admit she's done mighty well for herself."
"We'll have a chance to see her tonight," announced Lilas. "Mr. Hammond is giving a big supper to some of his friends, and we're going, Lorelei and I.
Demarest is down for her danse de nuit, they say. It's the limit."
"Hammond, the steel man?" queried the critic curiously.
"Sure. There's only one Hammond. But next on the newspaper story, this is a private affair."
"Never let us speak ill of a poor Pittsburgh millionaire," laughed Pope.
Scandal must never darken the soot of that village.
He turned as Slosson, the press agent of the show, entered with a bundle of photographs.
"Here are the new pictures of Lorelei for your story, old man," Mr. Slosson said. "Bergman will appreciate the boost for one of his girls. Help yourself to those you want. If you need any more stuff, I'll supply it. Blushing country lass just out of the alfalfa belt. First appearance on any stage, instantaneous hit, and a record for Polkatrude in an aggregation where the homeliest number is a Helen of Troy. Every appearance a riot. Stage door John standing on their heads. Members of our best families dying to lead her to the altar. Under a 5-year contract with Bergman and refuses to marry until the time's up. Delancey Page, the artist, wants to paint her. Says she's the perfect American type at last. Say, Bergman can certainly pick 'em, can he? I'll frame it for a special cop at the back door. Detailed to hold off the matrimony squad of society youths if you can use it."
"Don't go to trouble," Pope hastily deprecated. "I know the story. Now I'm going to leave and let Miss Lynn dress."
"Don't go on my account," urged Lilas. "This room is like a subway station, and I've got so I could change in Bryant Park at noon and never shock a policeman."
"You won't say anything mean about us, will you?" Mrs. Knight implored. "In this business, a girl's reputation is all she has."
"I promise." Pope held out his hand to Lorelei, and as she took it, her lips parted in her ever-ready smile.
"Nice girl, that," the critic remarked as he and Slosson descended the stairs.
"Which one? Lorelei, Lilas, or the female gorilla?
How did she come to choose that for a mother?" muttered Pope.
"One of nature's inscrutable mysteries, but wait, have you seen Brother Jim?"
"No, who's he?"
"His mother's son, need we say more? He's a great help to the family, for he keeps them from getting too proud over Lorelei.
He sells introductions to his sister."
Campbell Pope's exclamation was lost in a babble of voices as a bevy of swimming girls descended from the enchanted regions above and scurried out upon the stage. Through the double curtain, the orchestra could be faintly heard. A voice was crying, "Places!"
"Some soul kissers with this troupe, eh?" remarked Slosson, when the scampering figures had disappeared.
"Yes, Bergman has made a fortune out of this kind of show. He's a friend to the tired businessman."
"Speaking of the weary Wall Street workers, there will be a dozen of our ribbon winners at that Hammond supper tonight. 12 Bergman beauties, 12, count 'em. Anytime you want to pull off a classy party for some of your bachelor friends, let me know. I'll supply the dames at $100 a head and guarantee their manners. They're all trained to terrapin and know how to pick the proper forks."
"$100? Last year, a girl was lucky to get $50 as a banquet favor.
But the cost of living rises nightly. No wonder Hammond's against the income tax."
"Yes, and that's exclusive of the regulation favors. There's a good story in this party if you could get the men's names."
Pope's thin lip curled, and he shook his head.
"I write theatrical stuff," he said shortly, "because I have to, not because I like to, and I try to keep it reasonably clean."
Slosson was instantly apologetic.
"Oh, I don't mean there's anything wrong about this affair. Hammond is entertaining a crowd of other steel men, and a stag supper is either dull or devilish, so he's invited a good-looking partner for each male guest. It'll be thoroughly refined, and it's being done every night."
"I know it is. Tell me, is Lorelei Knight a regular frequenter of these affairs?"
"Sure, it's part of the graft."
"I see.
She has to piece out her salary like the other girls. Why, her whole family's around her neck, mother, brother, and father. Old man Knight was run over by a taxicab last summer. It didn't hurt the machine, but he's got a broken back or something. Too bad it wasn't Brother Jimmy. You must meet him, by the way. I never heard of Lorelei's doing anything really bad.
For the moment, Campbell Pope made no reply. Meanwhile, a great wave of singing flooded the regions at the back of the theater as the curtain rose and the chorus broke into sudden sound. When he did speak, it was with unusual bitterness.
"It's the rottenest business in the world, Slauson. 2 years ago, she was a country girl. Now she's a Broadway belle. How long will she last, do you think?"
"She's too beautiful to last long," agreed the press agent soberly,
"especially now that the wolves are on her trail. But her danger isn't so much from the people she meets as the people she eats with. The family of hers would drive any girl to the limit. They intend to cash in on her. The mother says so. And they will, too. She can have her choice of the wealthy rounders."
"Now, don't get me wrong," Slauson hastened to qualify. "She's square, understand?"
"Of course, object matrimony. It's the old story. And her mother will see to the ring and the orange blossoms. But what's the difference after all, Slauson? It'll be hell for her. And a sale to the highest bidder, either way."
"Queer little gink," the press agent reflected, as he returned to the front of the house. "I wish he wore stiff collars. I'd like to take him home for dinner."
As Pope passed out through the stage door, the judge called hoarsely after him.
You'll keep your eyes skinned for a job for Lottie, won't you? Remember, swellest legs in burlesque.
Please join me next time for another romantic chapter of The Auction Block by Rex Beach, here on Love's Tender Flame. Until then, love deeply and live beautifully.